You're listening to Ride Along, EMT School. I'm Mike.
And I'm Max. We're two students navigating EMT school, bringing you along week by week.
And I'm Jonathan, a paramedic bringing real-world perspective.
Join us as we share the lessons, challenges, and stories from EMT school, and hear insights from those already living the EMS life. Welcome to the Ride Along. And we are back again
with Jonathan is back joining us.
Yes. Finally. We've missed you, sir.
Slacker.
We were struggling without you.
It was horrible.
Hey, man, night shift. I had to do it.
I know.
Didn't want to, but I had to.
Max and I were sitting here, I think in, what was the last episode? Oh, primary assessment.
Yeah.
Was our last episode.
Yeah. I had a minor aneurysm in one of those.
Yeah. Oh, you did have like a minor aneurysm. Oh,
it was horrible.
You could see it in the video. He has like a weird thing that happens and he like goes completely silent. It's like
it was weird.
And I'm like, are you okay?
Am I having a stroke?
A TIA. You had a TIA.
Yeah. No, what I had was there was literally like I moved and there was a shot of pain straight up into the back of my neck, like up into like that little divot there. Uh-huh. And it was like I looked down and like none of the words made sense for like 5 seconds. I'm like,
you may have had a TIA.
So it was fun.
Yeah.
Good times.
Well, not that we plan to talk about this, but it's so interesting because like I just experienced my first kind of call with stroke symptoms. So sure. I had my third shift at the EMS department last week, and one of the calls was for like an 83-year-old lady whose daughter called and said, hey, my mom's not acting right. She's acting weird. And we got there, chatted with her, and she seemed okay, maybe a little confused. Nothing I hadn't seen before at this point, because I've seen some, like, you know, altered status, and I've seen, like, dementia. But she had, like, the quintessential form of expressive aphasia. Is that what it's called? So basically, like the lead EMT, he took his pen out and he held it out in front of her, and he's like, "What is this?" And she goes, "Well, that's a,
yeah,
it's," and she got frustrated because she could not say the word, and she said the same thing happened with like, "Oh, who's the president? It's that guy that I don't like, and his name is," and she just couldn't say. I'm like. That I know, like, I don't know all the stuff, but I'm like, that I know is a big, you know, red flag for stroke.
Yeah, for
sure. And if you're not paying attention, you know, if you're just trying to phone in, get through this call, like that's something that you can miss pretty readily. So it's a super important thing. And, you know, interacting with patients, family members can kind of be, you know, an interesting thing to do. But if they say mom and dad are not acting correctly, or hey, my husband's not acting correctly, it's, you should listen to them.
Yeah, for sure, because they're used to them, so
they know better than anyone else.
Exactly.
You know, you may not get that 100% of one-sided weakness and facial droop and all those things associated with a stroke. It may be more subtle signs.
Yeah
She did have a well it looked like when we did this, well, when I say we, I observed, because I'm very new and I'm just trying to like be the good helper, like, oh, you need the thing, here's the thing.
Sure.
And it was holding the two arms out, is it drift, right?
Yeah.
So arm drift.
Yeah,
she did exhibit a slight dip in one arm. So I knew that was one of the ones. And then like the smile test where you're seeing if they have equal muscle tones, I guess, on, and then they did the physical exam where she's like pushing with her arms and feet. We haven't gotten to that in school yet, so I don't know the terminology, but like, I just know that these are all kind of like psychomotor type exams, and she did have some things. And then like, as we were in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, there was, she did seem to get better. So
sure.
The expressive aphasia kind of went away. She was able to like identify keys and other items. And then when we got there, she was kind of doing fine. And, we found out later, when we came back, because we had three calls that day to the same hospital, and one of the paramedic went and checked, just like, hey, just because I guess that's one of the benefits of having good relationships with the hospital. They were like, yeah, she was clean, like nothing on the scan, nothing. So it might have been like a mini stroke or something. But
yeah, that TIA we were just talking about, Max had.
Yeah, exactly.
What does that mean, TIA?
Transient ischemic attack. Basically, it's what you know people refer to as a mini stroke.
Okay.
So it's you know could be an occlusion that gets resolved on its own, but it is causing those neurological deficits in that moment. And then and here's the big takeaway with that: a TIA is often an indicator for a larger stroke coming in the future. So it's one of those things we don't want to write that kind of thing off.
Right.
So hopefully the providers at the facility, you know, were like, hey, you know, maybe we got to put you on a blood thinner or something like that.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Well, yeah, I learned a bunch the other day. It was an interesting day, including, and this is a good segue, I got to see a lot of secondary assessments.
Okay.
So like, you know, seeing size up, getting through the door, seeing like, you know, the immediate life threats. Luckily there were none in the day that I was out there, but secondary assessments definitely were used, and got to see those continually kind of.
And that seems to be the bread and butter.
Yeah.
Of most of what you're going to do, most of what you're going to see, most of what you record. So seeing more of those has got to be only a good thing.
Well, you know, I'm pretty sure, and this was one of the themes I think in class, you know, to do this whole patient care thing and the secondary assessments, it's almost like you have to talk to people.
Talking to people?
And
no.
You have to interact with them.
Oh my God.
It's almost like that's 95% of the job is is actually making a human connection with somebody. And then, you know, of course you're trying to help them through whatever's going on, getting them to better care and all that stuff. But yeah, it's like the whole job is like, hey hon, how you doing? What can I do? Like, why'd you call us today? Like, are you feeling all right? Sure. What's going on? Have you had this happen before? And like you get that cadence going. Like I was amazed at seeing people kind of doing it for real on the job, because they make it seem so effortless just because they know what questions to ask and move into and just flow. And I'm like, that's where I want to be. Mm-hmm. Like I need a bunch of practice. I need experience to do it, but I got to see what it should be. I got to see, and I was like, that's cool. Like that, I had one of those kind of perfect connection, like, oh, I learned it in class. I got to see it in the field, and then seeing them come together.
And while we're doing updates, I'm no longer a slacker.
You are no longer a slacker.
I am no longer
I'm proud
a slacker.
Of you.
I'm no longer ashamed to the podcast. I am now a full-fledged member of an ambulance squad. I'll be doing hopefully my first ride along this weekend.
Oh man.
So I'm looking forward to it.
I think you had said you signed up in the last episode.
Mm-hmm.
And then I know you had your orientation day and got to meet all the guys at that new place.
And like every instructor that we have in class is part of that ambulance company.
It sounds like you guys might be a little bit ahead of the learning curve as far as like getting patient contacts. Are these counting for you, or do you have to wait until you're released?
We got released last week.
Yep.
Excellent. So you guys are already ahead of the ball game. That's perfect.
Yeah. I mean, I had two ride alongs before I got the paperwork to actually do it. Mm-hmm. And then in this last, the last run that I did, I did vitals and helped with asking questions and doing the secondary assessment. So that counted, awesome. You know, filled out the form, got all the vitals in there, and
he's
going to
have,
off.
He's going to have like 50 of them.
Well,
he's going to hand
I
a stack
hope I do.
Of like 50 assessments. Say, here you go.
Well, I'm just only going to hand in 10, but
no, you handed 50.
No, but I mean, I want to leave with 50. Like I would love to leave with 100, like, you know, just
you
because
you should just put them in a binder and mic drop them on his desk.
Yeah. Just like throw them up in the air.
The way that's gonna go for either of you is gonna be like you're either gonna get all of your calls immediately, or you're going to struggle to get those calls.
I'd be fine with one every shift. That should work out just perfect for me. But
yeah, 100%.
It's gonna happen a lot. Like I was on three runs and then got one patient contact from that, because on two of them I was kind of being like, hey, this is more advanced than I feel confident in helping with, like, and I'm going to take the step back. Oh, I totally messed up the other day, by the way, too. I haven't told you yet. But this is what we do, right? Part of being an EMS is recognizing, you know, the AAR, figuring out what you did wrong, how you can improve. So we did not get a lot of experience plugging in oxygen hoses in class.
Ah.
And apparently there are two things that look like the place to connect an oxygen hose on a tank.
There are indeed.
Uh-huh. There's the little slip nozzle thing that looks like a step bit for a drill. Like it's got the different sizes and you slide onto it.
Yep.
And then there is a threaded like half inch nipple type thing where it's got threads on it. Well, they handed me the other side of the nasal cannula and said, hey, hook this up to the oxygen tank. And I said, okay, well, that's a half inch round thing. That's a half inch round thing. This looks like it's got little threads on the inside. That looks like it's got threads on the outside. And I just stuck that thing on there. After the run, the advanced EMT that was with us, he's on his learning shifts. He's like, hey, by the way, so that thing doesn't go there. Like it doesn't go on that nipple. It goes on the other thing. I was wondering why that thing was whistling so loud the whole ride to the hospital. He's like, I'm honestly impressed that you got it on there. I'm like, I did it. I just screwed it right onto that thing. And he's like, yeah, that's how you piggyback that to another tank. And I'm like, I will not forget that.
So, and you can also use that particular threaded thing for some different devices. CPAP is one of them. Some CPAPs it's a bypass valve, so it'll just open the tank all the way up and you'll get all the oxygen all at once, which if you're running CPAP, which some devices require that.
Yeah.
So. But hey, you're exactly right. You live and you learn. Yeah. I mean, I've got a lot of stories like that.
I mean, luckily it wasn't like a critical case. It wasn't like, oh, he needed oxygen. Like we were providing oxygen for comfort. I mean, really, like who was it for? The patient was not in respiratory distress because there was none that day that were in respiratory distress.
Right.
Then I'd feel even worse about it. But it was kind of like, you know, hey, it was one of those things too, where it was everybody was task saturated and I'm like, sure, I'll help. And I put that thing on. I was like, it's on there, right? And you know, there might've been of course. How could you screw up putting the oxygen line on? Well, I did. And, you know, hey, you know, that's what happens. But
that's how you learn. I mean, the reality is you learn through your mistakes. You can learn through successes too, but you learn more through mistakes that you make.
100%.
Trick is fail tiny.
Yes.
Fail tiny and often.
Don't blow up the ambulance. That would be bad.
The big thing about that is, like, as a student, the people you're with and doing your ride-along shifts with, they should be paying attention and not throwing you to the wolves. Maybe a little bit just to get you out of your comfort zone. But, like, really, you know, and it's cool that he caught that and was like, hey, let's talk about this and have a little bit of a discussion.
Like, a little hot wash like that. Yeah. Because I was very open, too. Like, after each run, I was like, hey, totally open to feedback. Was I okay? Did I get the blood pressure all right? Was I in the, like, you know, am I in your space? Cause I don't know the rhythm yet. Right. Like, hey, like I'm totally fine with you telling me like, get out of the way. Don't stand here. Yep. Don't move around me. Make me move around you. Yep. And he was like, no, you're doing great. You know? And then there was that one thing where it was like, so that doesn't go there. That goes in a different spot. I'm like, yes. Gotcha. But,
big deal.
It's fun. It's interesting that it all exists, like the learning exists in the real world environment where there's an actual patient there.
And the real world, it can have consequences. Tactical environment.
Yeah. But that's medicine.
Yeah.
Like you have to that's exactly what I was hoping for.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've said it before on the podcast, but it always comes up. But we call it practicing medicine for a reason, right? Because we're not perfect at it. None of us.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. So before we go much further into the podcast, because I know we actually, you know, we got a little off topic already. But
got off topic.
Yeah. Hey, that's what happens. This is why it's a podcast and not like a YouTube short. You know, we'd be done by now.
Exactly.
The we should mention our sponsor slot.
They're pretty amazing.
Which is not a sponsor
yeah.
For tonight. It's us. So did you know that you can finally rep your favorite podcast? And no, I'm not talking about the Joe Rogan Experience. I said, that's right. We just dropped the new Ride Along Firehouse t-shirts. They're styled just like your local fire and EMS department shirts, but these ones let everyone know you're part of the ride-along crew. We've got four versions, one for students, one for EMTs, one for paramedics, and one made just for podcast listeners. So whether you're still in class or already saving lives, there's a shirt for you. And if you just want to fuel the caffeine addiction that keeps this show alive, you can always hit that buy us a monster button to donate to the podcast and support our energy drink addiction. So head on over to ridealong.bulletin.net or hit the link in the bio and grab your shirt and check out all the links.
The shirts turned out awesome.
They
look great.
They look pretty cool. Yeah. It's in the mail right now.
I can't wait.
We got three coming.
They would be on us right now if we had them.
Yes.
And I tell you, folks that have been doing this a minute, they love t-shirts.
Yes.
Yeah, they love t-shirts. And it's like one of those things where if you travel, one of the things people like to do is go to different departments and see if they get a t-shirt from a different department.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to have there's a reason I chose the kind of firehouse design. Because mm-hmm. I love, like, I mean, it's cool, I guess, to have a uniform and feel like you're part of a, you know, a thing. I'm not a big uniform person. Like,
sure.
Uniforms, they feel stuffy and they have a lot of extra fabric on them. But those firehouse shirts where, like, it's got the station number on it. And then, like, you know, you get the back that says paramedic or EMT yeah. on it. Like, I'm actually really looking forward to the day that, because I got myself a student one. And I'm really looking forward to the day where, hey, I'm going to upgrade my own t-shirt to the one that yeah. says EMT.
I want to get a giant Velcro feel on the back of mine.
That won't feel hot at all.
And be like, and like have a percentage number here and then EMT and just like 30% EMT, 40% EMT.
Yeah. Well, you know, eventually you'll get there.
Yeah.
And Jonathan, of course, gets the paramedic version.
Yes, he does.
Because he's super extra.
And we have them starched just for him, right? We have them nice and starched out. That way they're crisp lines.
Yeah,
No.
that's not me, man.
I got him the one that's like made out of burlap.
Oh, so yeah.
Like super starchy.
Yeah exactly.
Yeah. a nice pressed t-shirt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's gotta be like, you gotta have the corners just right and then like folded in thirds.
I mean, everyone has seen someone that like is wearing a t-shirt and jeans and it looks like it was just pressed and out of like a dry cleaner's. It's like, then why are you wearing a t-shirt and jeans? Like, why? What's the point?
Yep. But yeah, so the plan is, you know, those are available to everybody, but also I think that'll be our gift to people as they come on the podcast.
I would love to do giveaways with that.
That'd be great.
That'd be awesome.
I think that'll be part of our little, you know, party bag.
Should we mention the giveaway?
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, there you go, people.
Yeah. Well, because...
Never mind.
Well, I mean, if anybody's... Like, we can talk about it, because by the time this airs, it will be over.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Right? Because we have a delay in our days. But... We have been doing a giveaway, and hopefully we will be doing more giveaways. So like there might be one running when this one goes live of really cool things given to us to hand out to listeners, like for instance right now, or the first thing that we did was the X Shears giveaway.
Yeah.
Those
things are great.
Yeah. Which I think this will be heard sometime in November. That one will end in October 20th. So, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So keep your eyes open, people. There will be giveaways.
We're going to keep doing giveaways.
Check out our socials. Yeah. You'll see them there.
Yep. So, very cool stuff. A lot of exciting things happening for the podcast. And you know what? By the time people hear this, there might be more merch on that page too.
Exactly.
So hats and another cool, maybe water bottles. You know, you stay hydrated on your shift. All right. So, where are we?
Medical term of the week, sir. Actually, we're going to talk about the episode overview.
Oh, well, we kind of touched on.
So then we're medical term of the week, sir. Yeah. What is your medical term of the week?
So the medical term for this week is definitely one that comes up a bunch in terms of secondary assessment. Maybe not actively. Maybe somebody isn't going through it in their head all the time, but I have found that it is a very useful mnemonic for me in remembering all the things that I should be doing in the patient history phase of the secondary assessment, which is OPQRSTSAMPLE.
That didn't sound like a word.
It is. Well, half of it's a word. So OPQRST is a mnemonic.
Yep.
And so is SAMPLE, sample. They're two separate halves of a combined mnemonic.
Mm-hmm.
Half of it deals with the present. So OPQRST is getting into what is the current history of illness that the patient is exhibiting. Right. Sample deals with the past medical history for that,
yeah,
for that patient, right? So what is it? A mnemonic, if anybody is unfamiliar with what a mnemonic is, it is a short pattern of letters or words or phrases that make it easier to remember longer ordered pieces of information. So in this case, OPQRST stands for onset, which is when you're asking somebody, hey, when did, like, if somebody is presenting with a broken leg,
mm-hmm,
we'll just use that as an example, right? Oh, when did this happen? When did the pain start?
Right.
What was the onset, right? Provocation is the P. So what provoked it? Like what made it worse?
So if I squeeze here, does it hurt more?
Yes. If I squeeze, does it make it hurt more? If you put weight on it, does it make it hurt? Right. So what provokes the injury or illness? Quality. Like how bad does it hurt? Like on a scale of 0 to 10.
Well, that's severity.
Right? Yeah. Well, quality. Oh, sorry. You're right. So quality is what does it feel like?
Right. So it's a sharp throbbing.
Yes.
Right.
Is it like grinding? Mm-hmm. Is it ripping? Yeah. You know, like what does it feel like? What is the qualitative aspect of the pain or the symptom?
Mm-hmm.
The region/radiation, that's the R. You know, where is it? Does it move? Does it radiate down your leg? Does it feel like it's twinging a nerve that radiates up into your crotch? Like if you're talking about the leg, all those things can happen. Severity is the S. So severity being, you know, that scale.
I think that's a silly scale with face that's upset and the face that's really happy. And where are you in that mix?
From 0 to 10, rated on a scale. I can say with full confidence that I have felt a 10. Like kidney stones, by the way, don't mess with those. Like do whatever you can in your life to avoid kidney stones. That was a 10.
Yeah.
Hands down. So, but the thing is, that could be different for everyone.
I had a 10 with my back.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was, I could not stand for more than 30 seconds.
And then time.
Yep.
When, like, how long has it been going on? Yep. So,
right.
It may have happened just now. What was the onset? Like, oh, it was 20 minutes ago. Or it could be, man, this thing has been acting up for weeks.
Yep.
And it's just been getting worse and worse and worse each day. And things are usually supposed to get better with health each day. Hopefully.
Especially for stubborn people that don't want to go to the doctor. They can take care of themselves. They don't need help like every medical provider that's ever existed on the face of the earth.
That's real.
You know, oh yeah, I fell, you know, and it's been nagging me for a week or two, but now I can't move because it's so much pain that, you know, I made it worse because I didn't listen to anyone. It's almost like I've done that.
So OPQRST is the present illness. And then you want to move into the past illness. Because right now, I mean, the way I think of it is the right now is the most important thing. So I'm probably rolling right into OPQRST first because that's what I need to know. Like that'll help me ask the next questions.
Sure.
And then sample is the past history, standing for signs and symptoms, which actually I did a little bit of research into sample and OPQRST as well. Because I was curious, like, when did this start becoming ubiquitous to EMT training, because everyone talks about it. It's in everything. And it's like, wow, it's very set and everyone uses the same thing. And it's it actually started in like the 1970s, and it became formalized in the 1980s. I think 1985 is when sample actually came first, the past history model, or the past history mnemonic. And they were using that, and then they realized, being that deals with like the first S being signs and symptoms, they're like, there's not enough data. Right. There's not enough information that we're getting in the signs and symptoms.
Yep.
So then they started developing OPQRST to blow out the first S in sample.
Right.
So that's why it comes first. Cause like, you need to talk about like what's going on right now.
Yep.
So that starts with OPQRST and you go into sample. So the S in sample is signs and symptoms, which you kind of go into in OPQRST. Then you go into allergies.
Mm-hmm.
What allergies do you have? Well, I'm allergic to penicillin and commitment.
That's kind of important.
Like most dudes. you know, hey, everyone's got their thing. So allergies. M is medications. What medications are you on?
Why would that possibly be important?
I swear. Like, so I got to see my first example of somebody holding up a bag of medications on a run the other day.
Which big box store was the bag from?
Oh, man. It was just a plastic baggie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Like a Ziploc. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's like, what medications are you on, dear? And she goes, well, all those. And then like the paramedic held up the bag and starts reading it and like, And then she starts writing them all down one by one. And I'm like, man, that's going to take forever. And then she goes, well, the sheet's right there with it too. And then you look on the table and there's literally a printout of her medications. And I'm like,
uh-huh.
You do this often. Like enough people ask you often enough what meds you're on that you have a sheet.
When my mother moved in with us, she had a basket that had 3 gallon Ziplocs with all of the crap that she took. And I'm like, okay, we need to figure this out. She had medications that she was prescribed 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That were completely unnecessary that she was still filling and taking. It was unreal. So I think that is a very, very common thing to run into.
So
100%.
Medications is a big one. Yeah. I mean, hopefully most of the time people are either on none or one or two, and then you know what they are, but like you may have to
that
start.
Ain't how it is.
Yeah. And it's not real. Like I have my dreams of what it was. And then I'm like, nope, this is because actually, unfortunately, like the reality is a lot of the patients that I think interact with EMS the most are elderly, and elderly patients have this high pill burden, this, polypharmacy going on.
Pharmacy, yeah.
And like that's something that you have to be really cognizant of. As a matter of fact, I think our class coming up this week,
yes,
is pharmaceuticals. Yep. So I'm curious to see how that goes. And actually, I've got a little bit of background.
I already talked you up to the instructor. I said Mike's going to just sail through that.
Well, maybe not. I don't know medications. I told Mark
like he worked in pharmaceuticals stuff for years. Like he is just going to sail through that class.
Well, maybe. Hopefully.
Everyone's going to cheat up.
Fingers crossed. So the M in sample is medications.
Yep.
The P is pertinent past history. Pertinent being, I think, the key word.
The key word there. It's almost like it's the word. It's the word that the letter's coming from.
Yeah, it's like, my chest hurts. Okay. Well, what type of medical history do you have? Well, I once had a hangnail on my left pinky toe in 1963. It's like, oh, that's good to know, but I don't need that. I need like, do you have any previous cardiac, you know, history?
Yeah. So, and while we're, you know, talking about it, you will get some patients who are like, hey, do you have any medical problems or any medical history? Do you take any medications? Right. So, and if you ask about history, you should definitely ask about medications. As you know, we're kind of going through mm-hmm. sample, but you will get people who will be like, "Oh no, I don't have anything wrong with me." As soon as you get them to the ER, they start telling the nurse about all the things they've had going on.
Uh-huh.
It's like, wait, you told me you didn't have any medical history.
Yeah.
So it's a very common thing. Or, don't be surprised when you run into it.
I'm sure I'm gonna run into somebody who's like, "Oh, okay, are you on any medications?" Nope. And then it's like, well, are you having trouble breathing? Why? It's like, well, I could really use my asthma inhaler. Hey, you know that medication thing? That's a medication.
Yeah.
Right? So, oh, well, I didn't think that was relevant. that one's relevant.
Yeah. And well, story time at some point of of people not telling doctors about blood thinners.
Oh,
and then yeah. being, and then being put on double blood thinners and then causing them to almost die.
Wow.
Like stuff like that. Like that's why it's important.
We haven't gotten into blood thinners yet, but I'm noticing that as a trend.
Oh my God.
Every patient handoff, every patient interaction. I've picked up on, hey, are you on any blood thinners?
Yeah.
It's an important question.
It's a very important question.
Why fix diet and habits instead? Let's just throw medications in you to make it flow easier.
Come on. So, in sample, P, pertinent past history, L, last oral intake, which could be good to know just for a whole host of reasons. Sure. I know they want to know it at the hospital usually so that they, like if somebody needs to go straight into surgery, they need to know how susceptible they are, although it's not really going to matter because you're not going to change any of that as you're bringing someone in, but it's good for them to know. But it could also kind of give some insights into nutrition and how that patient is living, or even something like, you know, dehydration and blood.
When's the last time you drank some water?
It's been a couple days.
The other thing is, and this kind of, all these, you know, relate to one another, but allergies. You could maybe be exposed to something that you never had an allergy to before. And so it's like, oh, well, I had some mushrooms. Oh, I've never had mushrooms like this before. And now they're causing me some GI issues or whatever. So
psychosomatic issues too, I think, if you're talking about mushrooms. What type of mushrooms were these? I don't know, but I can taste colors.
I can taste colors now.
I can feel my teeth.
It's like they all interweave with each other, I think, right?
And I think the best thing about, you know, the mnemonics for me is that for me, especially my brain, it organizes my questions, it organizes my path of what I'm going to do. Because for me, that's the hardest part, is wanting to rush through, jump to the thing instead of slow down and just take your time. And having that organization to go through, for me, it really helps my brain. And I think ultimately will make me much more successful in the job.
Yeah. So I was introduced heavily to mnemonics when I was going through my private pilot training. And when you get into flow charts basically you either go by checklists or you go by flows. I was taught more of the flow pattern type stuff where it was, hey, you're going to learn flare. And honestly, it's been so long since I flew, I can't remember what they all mean. But like, I was so on it at one point. Like, I knew what I needed to do next, and my brain was just in the right rhythm. And that's where I'm at with these, is like they're helping me get into rhythm. And so, like, you know, and just to finish this off for sample, E is events leading up to illness or injury. So what were you doing? Like, were you out mowing the grass? Okay, that could give us some insight. You were physically exerting yourself. You know, that's how you broke your leg, or that's why you have chest pain and all that stuff. So
I think most homeowners should have certification to own a ladder. I think it should come. There should be a need for a certification before you're able to purchase it.
Well, we can get into that at some point. But what should people have to get certifications in life?
A ladder.
Yeah, ladders. Okay.
Ladders.
But yeah, so we have these two like complementary mnemonics that flow from one to the other, talking about the now into the past. So we have OPQRST and sample. So that's the medical term for this week is that mnemonic. Now,
here's a way to look at these. We are trying to paint a picture of the patient, and all of these different letters in the mnemonic, they're different colors we're painting with. And if we use all of them, we're painting a complete picture of this patient. So that's kind of how I look at it, right? Being a visual person. So I'm painting a picture and I'm using all the things to paint the best picture I possibly can paint of this patient.
Yep. So. I'm very much paint by numbers type of guy.
Green goes in one.
Yeah. I'm a fan of colors that have the name on the side of them, because it's tough being colorblind.
Oof. He is colorblind. It's going to come up.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm actually a little worried about like how it may affect being a provider. Like, but I will cross that bridge when I come to it. I haven't run into anybody that says it's an issue, but
why are you feeding that patient argon? We're supposed to be using oxygen. Well,
I'm not dyslexic. I have colorblindness.
The tank color looks the same. They both look like a mottled gray.
Max, why is there a bottle of argon in an ambulance?
I don't know. It was the first gas in a tank that came to my head.
It was acetylene. I just put it where the oxygen went. It's oxyacetylene.
Right.
They go together.
Yikes.
So, Jonathan, in the real world, I hate it when I say that. In your daily life doing these types of things with assessments, do you feel yourself still going through like that kind of rigid, like I know what needs to happen next, or is it more intuitive at this point?
I would have to say that it's more intuitive at this point. It takes a while to develop a flow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that being said, if something is just stumping me, we revert back to these things, right?
Okay.
We revert back to the mnemonic device. It's like, all right, this is stumping me. All right, let's go through the checklist and check the boxes.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, it is observing your patient. It is, doing other assessment things. And for me at this point, what I find myself doing is another mnemonic device that I utilize and I use in my classes and I got from another instructor, John Farnham. He uses the mnemonic WIN, WIN, and it stands for what's important now.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a provider, I ask myself, what's important now?
Yeah.
Right. As a student, when you're trying to build that flow, you're going to go through OPQRST sample.
Yep.
Just the way it is, because you're trying to remember, you're trying to build that flow. But as you get some experience, as you build your skills, it will not be exactly like that. And maybe in your ride-alongs, you've seen that.
Right.
Where something is more pertinent in the moment than going through that that OPQRST sample.
Yeah.
Line for line.
I think, I got to see some focused assessments, like, because mm-hmm. we're going to, now is as good a time as
might
any
as well.
to kind of get into, like, some of the different aspects of secondary assessments. But I did get to see a bit of a spread in terms of, hey, we're going to treat this broadly, figure it out, kind of more of a general secondary assessment versus, hey, we know exactly what could be happening with this patient. Like, they have a very specific complaint. So we're gonna first focus on that because it's, for lack of a better term, the low hanging fruit, right? Like we know that the likely answer is going to be in this set of criteria. What is that? There's a medical term that kind of relies on that principle. I think it's like when you hear hooves, think horses, not zebras. I don't know if you've ever heard that one in the medical world.
No, I haven't heard that. But what is the most likely thing that we're
right
encountering?
I think that's a medical expression. I think I heard it in House way back, like because that show was all about finding the weird stuff that happens. But like typically, it's like if the answer is right in front of
Occam's razor, right?
The simplest answer is often the best one.
Yeah,
I think that's essentially the same principle.
Yeah, I mean that's if you start out with chest pain, what's the first thing we need to be concerned about? Well, cardiac chest pain, mm-hmm. right? But then as we delve deeper into this, I got hit in the chest with, a football. And also, it's a 17-year-old male and he's on the football team, right?
Yeah.
So what's the most likely answer? He's probably not having a heart attack. He's probably. So, the most obvious answer is usually going to be the thing, but not always. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we go down those paths and it's not the most obvious thing that you would think it is.
Yeah.
That's why understanding like the idea of differential diagnosis.
Yep.
Yeah. As I missed the last two episodes.
Did we dive into that at all?
Yeah.
So I think we did. Yes. As a matter of fact, there was a class where we were introduced to the concept of what a differential diagnosis is. And I think we explained it in one of those where it was basically right. like, and they were talking about it in terms of on your way to the call. Like you yep. can already start your mm-hmm. differential diagnosis by saying, hey, if someone's complaining of chest pains, doing the mental kind of run through of chest pains can be this, like, you know, there's a whole host of reasons. And then as soon as you get there, you get more information and you could start checking things off the list of like, well, it's not going to be this and it's not going to be right. this because I'm getting this piece of information. So you're creating your set yep. of things that right. you're eliminating.
Yep.
So, you know, perfect. We already talked about it. You know, you were talking about your call where you ran a stroke-like symptoms mm-hmm. call. And one of your differential diagnoses for stroke-like symptoms is and altered mental status is always going to be a diabetic problem.
Right.
So specifically low blood glucose.
To which I helped to get a blood glucose on that call.
Right. Nice. So that's going to be one of the things that you immediately check and are able to eliminate or confirm as to a potential cause mm-hmm. of the thing. So, and this is really where your secondary assessments start to come into play is, right. is being able to formulate those differential diagnoses.
Right. Speaking of which, little tidbit we've learned here. I think we may have mentioned this on the podcast before. So are there stipulations for your areas in terms of when you can use blood glucose meters?
You know, protocols are so regionally and sometimes even departmentally specific. I worked in a department. They're like, hey, you don't need to get a blood glucose on everybody. I currently work in a department where it's like, hey, this is just another vital sign. And
yeah,
if regardless, we're going to check this because it can be an indicator of some other things. If you've got somebody that's got an elevated blood sugar, but they don't have diabetes, that could potentially be a sign for, you know, an infection.
Right.
Or something to that effect. It's going to be department by department dependent. Yeah. Your protocols will guide you on that.
In Pennsylvania, like we learned in Pennsylvania, we are only like as EMT level, we're only allowed to administer or obtain blood glucose in stroke light symptoms or altered mental status.
Yeah, any altered mental status.
So it's just one of those things where I'm like, hey, I got to keep that in mind for when we actually get out there. But
and the reality is it's becoming more and more common too. We're seeing yeah. it more and more as just a regular thing of this is what is going on. So I think it's important to be able to efficiently do that skill.
So in the secondary exams, some of the things that we learned in class was that there's different, like while we've been chatting about the history taking aspect of it, mm-hmm. there's a couple mm-hmm. other parts of the secondary assessment, one of which being the physical exam.
Yep.
And this is like we've started getting into physical exams. It's mm-hmm. it's certainly, I think, a hurdle for students getting used to the idea of touching another human's body.
Yep.
Yeah. That we have to get over. And you know, the idea of like, okay, I'm really gonna start palpating and inspecting another human's like joints and bodies and chest cat, like, you know, like seeing if their chest is feeling correct, if their hips are folding or do like, you right. know, that kind of like full on physical assessment. Or, you know, maybe it's not a full physical assessment. It might be the focused physical assessment. Like, hey, I hurt my ankle. Well, we may not do a full body.
Right.
You know, yeah,
head to toe. You yeah, may just start yeah. with the ankle.
Yeah, we're just going to go there. And if there's other problems that pop up, we can address those. But if it's pretty much like localized, you know, a localized problem, then we're right. probably not going to be as invasive as we can be and kind of go everywhere. It's there's a obvious problem that we can treat.
Yeah. Now, one piece of instruction they gave us was like if you're doing a region, whether it's an ankle with your leg or your abdomen or your chest, is if they're saying it hurts here, to work your way around to it, to get them used to the fact that your hands are on them, that you're doing all there, you're palpating. Don't go directly to that source because then it's going to be kind of a shock. Kind of take your time moving around it, eventually getting to the spot that you're sure. that you're targeting.
Yeah,
that way they can get used to your pushing and pulling on their body. And you know, I think that's a huge point of instruction because it's way less of a shock to the patient.
It's probably a good technique just to get patients used to the idea of like, hey, you're
I'm going to touch
you. We're doing a physical exam right now.
Yeah.
So we have, you know, and the different types of things for a physical van, a physical exam. So looking, listening, auscultating, feeling, palpating, you know, those are all the things that we should be doing in those. And whether or not it's broad or more focused, if it's trauma, we're using another another acronym from the alphabet soup of EMS.
DCAP PTLS.
BTLS.
BTLS.
Yeah, DCAP BTLS. Which stands for deformities, contusions, abrasions, punctures, burns, tenderness, lacerations, and swelling. I do not know this one off the top of my head yet, and we haven't really gotten into trauma, but
sure.
it's yeah. another one.
Yeah, and you know, going back to the mnemonic WIN, what's important now, the presentation of your patient and what you were called for are going to dictate what you, you know, where you kind of start with that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you may do your life threats, your ABCs first, and then move right into DCAP BTLS versus going to your sample OPQRST.
Right.
Because while you're dealing with your life threats, there are other injuries that could
become developing. Yep.
Yeah, they could become life threatening if you don't deal with them.
Right.
It's we talk about arterial bleeding all the time, but could venous bleeding cause a problem? Yes, you can still bleed to death from venous bleeding.
Yeah, or. Yep. Can there be more subtle signs of deeper problems?
Yes.
So like
100%.
Like hemorrhaging or bruising on the body, you know, could that be a symptom of internal bleeding or
yes.
know, things like that? Like that's because that's not that as you come up on a scene and, you know, I think this topic, this particular point deserves to be restated as well, that all of this happens after the initial assessment.
Right, exactly.
ABCs, you know, you do not start going into anything in the secondary assessment, any of the details until you make sure there's no life-threatening things that are happening.
He could have an open fracture where you're seeing bone protruding from skin. You still have to make sure he's breathing.
Yeah.
He has an airway. And he has a pulse. And, you know, it that's your primary, even though there is this giant distraction that's right here, you know, pointing itself out saying, here I am. You still have to go through the ABCs and make sure that you're dealing with all the immediate life-threatening injuries.
Right.
That's like, you know, facial injuries or head injuries. They're because the head's so vascular.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's going to bleed a lot and be a distracting injury.
Sure.
And it's something I definitely want to deal with. But at the same time, I want to deal with this fact that this person isn't breathing at a rate able to sustain life.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So
like that has to happen first. Then we start going into the secondary assessment stuff. You know, we start asking, and what I also find really interesting, which I hope I get to a point or that I would like to, like I find is going to be a practice point for me to like my, how should I explain this? I think a benchmark of proficiency will be multitasking doing these things because the idea that I can, you know, take vital signs, which is the other aspect of a secondary assessment too. So like the physical exam, the patient history and vital signs, all of those things can happen all at once.
Yep.
So some people have the skill set to be like, oh, I'm taking a blood pressure. I'm asking questions and I'm also checking the arm at the same time. Like they can just, they know how to intuitively do that or just seamlessly go from one thing to the next and do it all kind of right in a flow. I'm like, man, that's where I want to be.
There's a student in class that did that.
Yep.
She was doing pulse rate, breathing, and blood pressure all at the same time in the same 30 seconds. Because I said to her, I said, okay, so do you need me? Like, no, I'm good. I was like, well, yeah, but we have to do more than that. He's, yeah, I'm good. And she had all three in that 30 seconds. I was like, my brain doesn't work that way.
Well, I think she works in a doctor's office.
So she does that
all day long.
Yeah.
Like she's been, yeah. Some people like, and it comes with practice, right? Like you can't assume that you could just jump in and do everything perfectly. Like I accept the fact that I need to work hard at that, but that is the thing that I want to attain is
goal to have.
Yeah.
And as you build proficiency in all these different skills, you will be able to do that. The other thing just to, you know, to mention to it, just remember you're part of a team.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're part of a team. So while one person is getting vital signs, the other person might be getting a history. And we tag team calls like that all the time at work.
Right.
Yep. I saw a lot of that. So, there were four people on the ambulance the last time I was there. And it was like, sometimes it was like, what is there to do? Like there's people, well, that, you know,
to that point. So it's like, you might have two people, you might have, you know, your primary AIC is talking to the patient and getting a history from them. And then, you know, the secondary provider may be doing those vital signs. Mm-hmm. And then the third provider may be even be like talking to the family or writing down medication list.
Yep.
Or looking at discharge papers from the recent hospital visit and kind of going through that to get an idea of what might be going on.
Yep,
so
getting the stair chair set up and, you know, ready yep. to move. Yeah.
There's work to be done. So, yep. You know, in our other interest, we talk about always be looking for work
yep.
in EMS. Mm-hmm. That's also relevant. Always yep. be looking for yep. work.
I find that that's been very helpful as a mindset for me in terms of, all right, well, I'm here. I'm going to be as helpful as I possibly can be, and I'm going to start looking for things to do wherever I'm at. Yep. Like, I think people appreciate that always.
And as you flow into a leadership role, realizing that your job isn't to do everything. Your job is to delegate people to do the things.
Mm-hmm.
So having that person that can give you those instructions and then keep their eye on the broad scope of things.
Yeah.
And that's been one of the hard things for me at transitioning into the role from an EMT to a paramedic. I'm getting the flow of it now, but being able to take a step back and realize I don't have to do everything. I can delegate.
Yeah. You got a bunch of people there.
And even as an EMT, I had to do some of that as well. Because if you've just got a BLS crew, somebody's got to be in charge and delegate.
Yes. Yep. And it's going to be whoever probably takes charge. Because it's not like, you know, not every place is going to have like a set, like, okay, this person's in charge over this person's in charge. I get the feeling it's probably going to gravitate to whoever is the one that, you know, seems to have some sort of leadership presence.
It's
which
gonna
is
going to be you. It's going to be you.
Not right now.
Eventually it's going to be, okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like people who teach tend to gravitate into positions of leadership, but like, sure. because that's what leadership yeah. Is like teaching. But the, the point I wanted to make though, about what Jonathan was saying in terms of you have a team at your disposal, mm-hmm. like everyone can start taking things. And even in yourself, becoming more proficient means that you get to open up your brain into doing the critical right. thinking
yep.
versus just the execution where right. it's like, you can get so bogged down into like, man, I'm having such a hard time getting this blood glucose level. And that's all you're focusing on. Like, I can't get the little drop to form on this patient's finger. And I keep dropping these, the test strips, and I can't get the battery to work in this blood glucometer. If it sounds like I'm reciting something that just recently happened to me, it's because it did. Like, this was me. Yeah. I'm like, you know, so focused on trying to help and get this, the blood glucose level, that I'm like, I don't know what else is going on. I'm so task saturated on just this stupid right. little device and like not dropping all of these little like test strips that I was like, I thank God there's, you know, a paramedic, a advanced EMT and another EMT that know what they're doing, because I can't figure this thing out. But like, that's what you do. Like, and that even the very basic and underskilled level of me helping with that thing allowed somebody else to not have to worry about that in sure. that moment.
Sure.
So it frees up the brain, and you like, you know, and this is one of those reasons why I want to work towards a level of proficiency, is because that will allow me to open up my brain. Like, and I've found that through other training disciplines that we do, where the more proficient I get, the less I have to worry about the doing the little things, and the more I can right. be, I can keep my head in the yep. game.
You get rid of it.
At an yes. upper level and go, hey, I know what's going on around me. I know everything that's going yep. like, I can make better decisions.
You get rid of that tunnel vision.
Mm-hmm. So that critical thinking was something we chatted about in class, mm-hmm. As well as reassessment. So like all this stuff we just talked about, all these things, all the little nuances, all the fact gathering, all of the history, putting those together into a picture, like Jonathan was talking about. We painted it. Guess what we got to do now?
Paint it all over again.
Do it all over again.
Yeah.
You got really good at, you see that picture? That picture's great. Give me another.
And then if you did interventions, you have to evaluate, were my yep. interventions effective? Are they still effective?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Like, did I put on a splint? Okay. Well, now I need to assess whether or not the splint was right. Or am I still getting pulses after I put the splint on? And then even later, it's like, okay, well, let me still double check to make sure that I'm still getting pulses on where I put the splint on so that it hasn't changed, because maybe stuff does. So you have to stay on top of it, right? So reassessment.
Yeah, no, that leads into another mnemonic device that's part of, you know, secondary assessment, PMS, pulse movement sensation.
Oh, we're not familiar with that one.
That now, when you get into your trauma lecture, they're going to talk about that. But that's you brought up splinting, so that's one thing. So we check pulse movement sensation before any application of a splint, or even before maybe some places allow reduction of fractures, right? So you pull traction and try and reduce the fracture. So you definitely want to establish that baseline. And if you don't have a pulse, maybe you're gonna do that reduction. But let's say you have a pulse before you put a splint on, you definitely need to check it afterwards, because maybe you've done something to occlude that pulse.
Right.
So anyway, mnemonic devices, secondary assessments. That's more trauma oriented, but it's still a relevant mnemonic device. Yeah. PMS.
Love the mnemonics.
And if you have a critical patient and you have a 20-minute ride, you're doing it every 5 minutes. That's not a lot of time.
Well, it depends on the patient.
Yeah.
It falls into two categories, right? Stable or unstable, or sometimes I've heard is there a difference between unstable and critical, Jonathan? I've heard those terms almost used interchangeably.
I mean, I would say that an unstable patient is critical.
Yeah, but exactly. Like
for me, and for the circles I've run in, stable, unstable, or this is the one that I like, sick or not sick.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of do your from the door assessment, be like sick or not sick, and then establish stable or unstable based on some more information gathering.
Because in those,
Yeah, I haven't heard critical used in that way, but stable and unstable is usually what we go with where I'm at.
Right, and within those two categories, that's where it determines how quickly how often you're reassessing. So for a stable patient, the minimum, and this isn't to say that you should only do it every 15 minutes, but the minimum is 15 minutes.
Yeah,
right.
And then for they've been using the term critical or unstable patient. It's every 5. So you should be reassessing every 5 minutes. And part of that is getting vitals. So you should be getting vitals as part of your secondary assessment every 5 minutes so that you can trend and trend that versus the baseline that you got when you first got there and to see how the patient is doing over time.
Right.
Right. So a lot of this is not like the snapshot. Like one picture is like, it's almost like, It's not being the perfect artist and like saying, hey, this is the most perfect picture I can possibly paint of this one moment in time.
Right.
It's I don't know why this is associating my brain this way, but it's like animators where they're like sketching and okay, well, I need to make a pretty good sketch of this moment. And then I immediately need to flip the page and make a sketch of something slightly different and then make so it tells a story over the different course all of the other pictures, right?
Prior to even saying that, I said we're on the same wavelength. I was thinking about the flipbook sketches where you start, you draw a slightly different picture and then you just flip through it and it almost creates a little cartoon
for like a little dude. I used to draw the same thing over and over again for some reason. It was a little dude jumping over a hurdle, like just a stick figure jumping over like a hurdle, and just in my notebook because I couldn't pay attention in class and I used to draw cartoons.
I would draw things exploding.
Yeah. Everyone's got their thing that they drew in their books. Yes.
Absolutely.
There were so many of those weird pointy S shapes in my notebooks.
You know
I know exactly what you're talking about.
I'm a kid of the 90s, right? Like the pointy S's were a thing.
Yes, 100%.
So that is kind of the rundown of all the secondary assessment stuff. Real quick, like obviously there's other considerations too. You're gonna keep in mind that like, or what they expressed to us was that it will be important to like change the way that you're assessing, not the assessment itself, but your approach to it based off of your patient. Mm-hmm. So you're going to take a slightly different approach to pediatric patients because you're going to not only be dealing with the patient, you're likely to be dealing with a parent and asking them for history versus the patient, because that patient's going to be like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I don't have a history. I was just born. Yeah, you know, like, like my history started 2 months ago. Or, you know, geriatric patients where we chatted about it before, like polypharmacy might be a much bigger deal to deal with in that instance. Right.
And then they also may not know what their history is. They may also say the same thing. Oh, 2 months ago.
I've seen a few times now is that kind of dementia side.
Yeah.
Unresponsive patients, trauma patients all have their own kind of things to look out for. Obviously trauma being like, hey, we may need to even switch around like the common initial assessment of like, instead of it being ABC, we may need to go CAB.
You mean if there's blood spurting 3 feet out, 3 feet out of a leg, we shouldn't go to airway first?
Well, 3 feet, if it's only 2 feet or like a foot and a half, it's not, I think there's a protocol somewhere. No, I'm joking.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like, That's
going to kill them first.
What's important now, right? Let's give John Farnham the credit that's due.
Absolutely.
He's awesome for anybody out there who is really interested in kind of tactical stuff. That's the guy, John Farnham.
Yes.
So I actually never heard of that phrase before, but I love it because it's like, what's important now? Secondary assessments. That's kind of like, it's just that little thing.
I mean, I think it's going to, realistically, time spent with patient, that is going to eat up the majority of your time with the patient.
Yeah. How much of your time is assessing patients, Jonathan?
I mean, all of it from the moment I walk in the door. From the moment I get dispatch information, I'm already starting my assessment of that patient, right? We talked about differential diagnosis earlier. And but as soon as I hit the door, I haven't even said a word to them. Maybe even as soon as I hit the driveway, I'm starting an assessment. I'm starting to paint that picture immediately.
Right.
That EMS is all about assessment.
Yeah. It's only all the time.
Right. That's all. Just all the time.
It's only all moments of every single moment that you're doing something with it as an EMT or a paramedic. It's only always.
Right. No big deal.
So that is, I mean, it's a huge topic. Like, and we went straight from primary assessment into secondary assessment, and it's a lot. It's a lot to kind of go through. Then we had a week of classes where it was like review stuff. So thankfully we did not just get a bunch of extra stuff piled on top of us after those.
I didn't mind.
And me neither.
I didn't mind. The review stuff for me is huge.
Yeah. So that is, that's the secondary assessment stuff.
And that's our main topic for the night.
Yeah. That's the rundown. Now with that, we have our tool of the trade, which
fits in kind of nicely into the secondary assessment,
because it's definitely a tool that gets used in secondary assessments.
We're talking about a pulse oximeter. And what that does is it reads the oxygen saturation in your blood, the percentage.
So
it gives you an idea of how well the body, how well the pulmonary system is getting oxygen into your blood.
So I have gas in my blood right now?
You do.
Yes.
Who knew?
So it just a quick thing on how it works. It shines a light through a translucent part of the body, usually a fingertip, and is using a sensor to detect how much light is absorbed by the blood. Okay. And that's physically how it operates.
So, okay. That's super interesting.
It is. It's a magic little tool. Little background. The pulse oximeter's development started with the foundational work in the 1940s. But the key innovation for a modern device was in 1972 by, I'm going to butcher this name, Takao Ayayagi, a Japanese individual.
I mean, he's obviously from Ireland.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it definitely a very Irish name.
Yeah,
And
Takuo Aoki.
I apologize to it. I knew I was going to butcher the name. I have successfully butchered that name.
More people should know his name.
They should.
Yeah.
And what he did was he used the ratio of red and infrared light absorption in the blood in the Jesus Christ in the pulsatile arterial blood to calculate the blood oxygen saturation. That's a lot of words.
Yeah.
And I did it horribly.
Max is great at reading.
Oh my God. And then later on, a guy named John Severinghouse and a couple others helped commercialize and integrate the pulse oximetry into clinical practice in the 80s.
So 1940s yes. and 50s, they figured 40, out 50s. They figured out that. Yeah,
but in 1972, that man, he was the key person that basically developed the technology. He also started a company which launched the first pulse oximeter back in 1976, so the year I was born.
Oh, wow. 1976. So it's been around.
It has been around.
For a while.
Like it has.
The 40s and 50s, people started figuring out this thing that, like, hey, you could shine light through the body and see the level of oxygen that is currently associated and or attached to red blood cells in the body. Yes.
Right. And then in 1986, the American Society of Anesthesiologists recognized it as an essential patient thing for safety. So it became a standard of care.
Yeah.
And then through the 90s and through COVID, it kind of became just an ubiquitous thing that was used by nurses and in your home as well.
Yeah, I could buy one for $20. Actually, as a matter of fact, I did.
Yeah.
It's in my vitals kit.
That's the crazy part is like the first time I saw one was because of my son. He had issues with onset asthma whenever he got sick. And sure. Going to the doctor's office and them saying, well, this is what you're here to do. It costs all this money to do it. And oh, by the way, I can buy the same thing at CVS for $35.
Yep.
So it's a simple thing. It costs nothing. It is very easy to use. You push a button, it does its thing.
Right. And in the EMS world, I've seen it used several times now. Mm-hmm. It's this little attachment thing that hooks onto the life pack, the cardiac monitor through a wire. And I've become, you know, I think I luckily I'm proficient enough to put the pulse ox on the finger. Like, thankfully, like I feel very confident in being able to do that. So they always hand that to me like, okay, put that sure thing, boss. I got it. Like this one, put me in, coach. Yeah. Put the pulse ox on the finger. Although I did mess that up the first time I did it, put it on upside down. Nice. Does not work when the light is on the bottom of the finger.
Nice. Nope. There is a limitation to it. It cannot distinguish between carbon monoxide and oxygen. So,
yeah. Well, some can't.
Some can't.
Yeah. The typical ones, like most cannot. But I believe somebody mentioned that there are versions.
There's a version. It's a little bit. It's quite bigger
and probably sure a lot more expensive.
Yeah. It's more expensive for sure.
Yeah, but if you have one of those plain ones and you've been in carbon, you've had poison from carbon monoxide. If you had a heater in your house that wasn't cleaned recently, or a vehicle in a garage, like it's not going to distinguish between those two things.
Right, because
it's something to be aware of.
The reason carbon monoxide is dangerous is because carbon monoxide binds to red blood cells just like oxygen does.
Yes,
and it takes the receptor up. So that the carbon monoxide can't get to the red blood cell, which means that it's not circulating around your blood.
Exactly.
Right. It actually has a higher affinity
for red blood cell. Yeah.
Yeah. And in that, in what we're talking about, if you suspect carbon monoxide poisoning, right, or you should suspect carbon monoxide poisoning, because even if somebody's been in that environment, they will have an O2 saturation of like 100%.
Yeah. Right.
Like their O2 saturation will be high. And you're like, what the heck? They're having difficulty in breathing. Start asking the questions about like, hey, do you have a furnace? Do you have, mm-hmm. you know, propane? Like, you know, where have you been working in an environment that's enclosed?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there are other signs, you know, cherry red skin, difficulty in breathing. Yeah. But if you know that about that particular assessment tool, then ruling out those things should be pretty simple.
Mm-hmm. And also a couple different limitations it has. If they have nail polish on, it won't be able to get through the nail polish. You need to scrape that off. You need to be able to get to the nail itself. If they have clear nails on, I don't think it's really an issue because it's going to be just as translucent as the nail is itself. But well, if they haven't painted.
It depends. So I was doing some reading and if it's a fake nail, it may not, like, even if it looks clear, it may not be clear.
Right.
Okay.
So you may have to remove fake nails, but essentially it's like what some people do in the life pack at the ambulance squad. Like, there is nail polish remover with in the kit, and, you know, stuff to remove dirt and whatever so that you can clean the finger. But I think also it's good to know that it works on any finger. So if they have one that's already broken off, you can use that one. Or
here's a question for you, Jonathan. Do the toes work?
I actually was getting ready to say, in some instances, another thing, and you may mention this, but like people who have cold hands, might not get a accurate reading, right? They might have poor circulation in their hands or extremities. That can be a limiting factor. And I've had some people that have had that where their hands are really cold, but they've had socks on. So we take the sock off, put the pulse oximeter on the toe, and sometimes you get it. Another thing is, for an adult, we have, the probe that obviously is adult size and goes on the finger. But they have a...
earlobe?
A disposable probe, yeah, that is for pediatrics, and they have them for adults as well. But for us, we carry the pediatrics because, you know, pediatrics, their fingers are going to be different sizes, so you want to be able to adjust that. You can take that probe and you can put it on the earlobe to see about getting a pulse oximetry reading. So
yeah, so it's all different types of ways, but the thing that really kind of amazed me about this is, like, it's a relatively new tool in the toolbox, but seems so well integrated into how people are assessing patients. Now, at the same time, everything that we've been hearing and makes total sense is you don't treat the numbers. Like, the numbers, at the end of the day, the numbers don't matter, because if somebody has 100%, you know, oxygen saturation, but if it still looks like they're having trouble breathing, treat the patients, not the numbers.
Yep.
However, to get have a tool that, like, instantly gives you, like, an efficiency number to know how their body is responding.
And pulse rate. Super cool. And, like, pulse rate as well. So you're getting more than one number out of it.
So you don't have to actually be there on the radial pulse the whole time to get to, you know, tying yourself up, you know, physically to do that.
Yeah, it allows you to do other things. I mean, that's the great thing about tools that are well-built and well thought out, is they give you that mechanical advantage.
Yeah. That's why I'll never, like, you know, some people poo-poo on that whole, like, you know, the automatic blood pressure cuff. Like,
right.
It's like, oh, well, that's lazy. I'm like, I'm fine with lazy. Like, if I can put that on and get a sense of how the patient is doing and be able to, like, use my brain and my hands to do other things at the same time, that's awesome.
Yep.
Right. So, as a student, since we're talking about it for the second, as a student right now, you should be doing manual blood pressures and counting manual pulses because you need to build the skills.
Yep.
But as you start to get into the field, and as you know, once you guys pass your EMTs and you're running on the trucks, you're going to find, hey, we're going to use automatic blood pressure cuffs and we're going to use pulse oximeters to, you know, count pulses and get SpO2s and stuff like that. Because it is a time saving measure, especially if you're taking, you can set the limits on those to where it will alert you at a certain limit if somebody's pressure drops below or goes above, and you can set a time limit where it'll do it every so often. So like for me at work, I took somebody 2 hours away, and for me to do a manual set of vital signs on them, that would have disturbed them more than just setting these things to run.
Yep.
That being said, the caveat is if something is off, or if you are going to do procedure or give somebody some medication, it's probably a good idea to get a manual pressure or a manual pulse count on somebody. And the one thing that the pulse oximeter doesn't tell you related to checking pulses is the quality of that pulse. Right. It gives you a number, but it doesn't tell you the quality.
Right. Because you can have the threadiest little pulse and it's still, it's going to represent the same thing as like a bounding pulse, right? Like
or the regularity as well.
Right.
Yeah. Regularity.
It's just giving you a number. So yeah, I think that's a good one. I think the pulse oximeter is a really interesting tool for and one that I think we're going to get a ton of
use out of. I think we're going to be using it constantly.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. So with that brings us to Jonathan's segment of the student tip of the week.
Student tip of the week. So as we've been talking about secondary assessments and getting out there and talking and interacting with people.
Weird.
Yeah, that's what the whole job is mostly.
No, I just want to sit in my basement away from people.
So
under the studio lights.
As we're talking about interacting with people, it helps if, as a student, you can recognize the community and the different cultural aspects and different demographics of the community you're working or volunteering in, because that's going to allow you to better communicate with those patients, right? There's some things that are culturally more appropriate in some cultures. There are things that are going to be, you know, just better ways of communicating with some folks based on demographics and age and different things like that. So you just being able to recognize the community that you're in and how to address them, always professionally, of course, but just being able to talk to them the way that they want to be talked to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of my tip as you're going through and starting your clinical time. Just kind of take a look at the community you're doing your ride time in and, you know, understand who those people actually are.
Yeah, I like it. So, yeah. I mean, that could be hugely impactful on your success and patient care and all the you know, you want to make sure that you're assimilating, probably isn't the right word, but you know,
I just look at it as
fitting,
like,
into
just recognizing and meeting people where they are,
yeah,
and in their community and understanding the nuances of that community.
Yeah.
And I mean, it could affect not just the patient you're with right now, but it could affect the next patient you're with, because
100%.
If they see you, they recognize you and you're showing them the proper respect and all those things, they're going to be way, way more inclined to be a better patient for you if they have to wind up being that person.
Yeah, I mean, and especially I see that with family members, because, you know, there's always some folks in the profession that maybe need to work on their professionalism. But I mean, in any profession, but in EMS is no exception. And I've been on calls where maybe the last time they interacted with this person or their family, it didn't go so smoothly. And those people remember.
Yeah.
And so they saw this person come in and like, oh, heck no. I don't want to talk to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, a lot of times, you know, if you've got a good partner, the partner can kind of jump in and diffuse that situation or whatever. But just being able to recognize where people are and the nuances of the community is going to pay off,
yep,
as you go through your ride along time and through your career.
Yep.
So
thank you, sir, for our tip. I will certainly keep that in mind as I experience the culture of my ride-alongs.
Yes.
Man, it's been fun so far. But, you know, everyone listening, please make sure that you're sticking around. Next episode, we have a real barn burner.
Oh, yeah.
We have the right stuff, which is reassessment, communication, and documentation. Just what all of us got into EMT stuff for.
Oh, like, yeah. Paperwork,
writing reports, and talking to each other.
That's it.
No, it's good stuff. Like, actually, there's a lot of good points in there and some really good life skills in general in terms of communication. So excited about that one. But you guys good? You got anything else for secondary assessments?
No, I think we're good.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening and taking the ride with us. We'll see you next time on the ride along. This podcast is for educational and storytelling purposes only. It is not medical advice or official EMT training. Always follow your accredited instructors and local protocols. Heartbeats racing in a-